Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is Wheel Bearings. I'm Dan Roth from Forbes.
I'm Rebecca Linlin from Rebecca Drives.
And I'm Sam of Blue All Salmon from Guidehouse Insights.
All right. We got to keep changing up the order so that everybody stays engaged and listens. I think that's the way we're going to grow our audience.
Okay.
Who is it
exactly.
This time? But let's get to what we're driving. And Rebecca, you have spoken in such glowing terms about the BMW X3e. I want to know why you love it so much, because the last time I was in an X3, I was kind of like, meh.
Well, it could be a little bit of because it was familiar and like putting on a favorite pair of old, you know, slippers. I had BMWs for 10 years. I had a Mini first, and then I had two X3s and an X5. And I will say that I, you know, there's things that I really, really loved about it. And I think it just was, it was very drama free, mm-hmm. which I appreciated. So one thing to note is that this was the plug-in electric. So it was the X3 E-drive, the X-Drive 30, I think it's called. X-Drive 30E
BMW's exactly. Nomenclature is so ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. Only to be surpassed by Mercedes. So this one gets, it has 60, up to 60 miles of electric range. And, you know, unfortunately, I was only able to charge it on a low 110, typical 110 volt, which then leads me to say that I really have to see about getting a high-speed charger in my house. But anyway, so I think what I liked about it was that it was very familiar for me. The ergonomics inside was easy to get to know. Things were where I wanted them to be. So, you know, the wireless charging pad was right there, which worked really well. The thing that did not work so well was that stupid gestures thing. Like, I just end up doing that scene from When Harry Met Sally. What are you saying that you fit? You know, I don't see the value in the gesture. And my favorite part was when it would remind me that it was there.
Oh, the gestures? Yes.
Yes.
Like, did you know? So
I would turn the volume up manually and I'd be like, oh, no, you can do that. No. So you know, it comes with the car, unfortunately, because otherwise I would never pay for something like that.
Is it standard equipment?
No, it's not. I'm sorry. It comes with part of a package, I would get heated steering wheel and stuff. So it's the executive package.
So you can disable all that stuff too. I don't know. I'm pretty sure you can probably disable the suggestions too, because the first time I had a BMW with the gestures, I was very skeptical. I was like, ah, we don't need that. And then I tried it on another one and I was like, okay, I get it. But every now and then us Italians will use our hands. And it'll do something you didn't expect.
Well, and that's the thing too, is I feel like it's a waste of investment in R&D. You know, it's one of those, like, I don't see what it really adds to the vehicle very much. There was other things I really liked about it. Certainly the acceleration with the e-drive was very good. It seamlessly transitioned from using the, when I ran out of my e-miles, which was, you know, pretty quickly, it seamlessly transitioned to the gas engine. I actually got almost 35 miles to the gallon. Which was impressive, because I can tell you that my previous X3s got nowhere near that. And that was with a lot of stop and go traffic that was on the highway. It was definitely a combination. So from that standpoint, you're getting really, really good fuel economy with very few compromises, which I very much appreciated. I also really liked the navigation system, and the heads-up display was very, very useful. So there were things that were really, really good about it. Like, I felt like it was that combination, as I said, of like putting on an old pair of slippers that are super comfy and very cozy with some really new, very latest technology. You know, from an exterior standpoint, it's a pretty standard looking BMW. They haven't really pushed the envelope from a design standpoint, but that didn't bother me. Like, you know, I kind of liked being almost anonymous in, you know, in a Gen X kind of way.
Well, certainly, you know, in Grunge, Connecticut, you know, being in an X3, you probably would be pretty anonymous.
X3 in Greenwich is almost like that's the kid's first car.
If anything, I was like the oldest X3 driver in the in Greenwich.
Yeah. And certainly, you know, getting 35 miles per gallon, is impressive, you know, especially if you can plug it in, you know, I think it's, I was just checking the EPA website, you know, it's 18 miles of electric range. You know, you can do a lot of your daily commuting without using any gas, you know, so, and then once you go beyond that, you know, 35 is pretty easy to do.
Yeah. So I drove a total of 65 miles in EV range. So over the course of a week, yeah. There was only a couple nights that I was able to charge it. The first night when I was at home, it actually didn't charge. And that was, you know, of course, driver operator error. I didn't realize that it wasn't charging. I thought I had plugged it in properly. I was using an outside plug and apparently it didn't work.
That's one of the things that can be confusing though with
absolutely
charging them. I had that issue with, I forget which car it was, whether it was a PHEV or an EV, but it was the same thing. It was like, is this thing plugged in? Is it charging? And it turned out, I think it was the Leaf. I had it on a an ungrounded plug, old house. So
yeah,
I had to switch plugs, and then it was fine. The charger could sense that it had a grounded plug, and off it went.
Right. But I did not realize that it wasn't charging, which, again, you know, we get these cars for a week. So as an owner, I think you would get to know what the different colors mean and stuff. Because then when I came out that morning and it wasn't charged, but I do wish that it had kind of flashed a little bit of like that, because I looked at the dash, because the dash actually said that it was going to be like 14 hours till a full charge. So I'm under the impression that it's charging. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, but then when I did charge,
once you plug it in, it starts the 14-hour timer.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Once you get it connected and get electrons flowing. Yes.
Right, exactly. So, you know, and then when I actually did get it charged, I was taking care of my mom, so I was up at my sister's. But so I plugged it into my sister's garage, and the blue little, like the little blue light inside the charging device on the car, that changed. It was white when I wasn't charging. It was blue when I was charging. That was the only indication that I had successfully charged it, because otherwise it looked the same. The experience from the dashboard standpoint looked the same, and it actually wasn't charging. So these are just things to get to know.
For somebody who's, you know, an owner of one of these vehicles, I think one of the advantages you do have is, you know, almost all of these, including the BMWs, they have an associated app, smartphone app. So you can actually monitor your charging on that, because these vehicles are connected. So you can check and see, you know, is it charging? You can also use it to schedule your charging. You know, if you do have a 240 volt charger in your garage, you can plug it in, but have it not actually start charging until later, you know, when you're, you know, whatever time your local utility goes to off peak rates, so you pay less. So, you know, that for a regular owner, you know, for us, usually sometimes, you know, I know with some vehicles I've been able to get, you know, the app working on my own phone, you know, create an account and get it connected to that car and be able to monitor stuff. A lot of times we can't, because they'll have that vehicle connected to a corporate account.
Right.
And so, you know, we can't use the apps, but yeah, that's something that would help for an average user.
Yeah. Right. BMW, I think we as reviewers miss out on a big part of the ownership experience, because you can do quite a bit through the app, even with navigation and the way they want their cars to feel like an extension of that smartphone experience, where it learns your route and it tells you, hey, you know, it checks traffic around the times you would commute and stuff. So it tries to be, you know, very helpful and integrate in your life with the app. And if you don't have it, you know, then we're reporting about the car and the driving and sort of the things that we've always talked about, but we're kind of blind to that other part of the ownership experience. It actually may be really important and really delightful to an owner. This is the same powertrain that's in the Mini Countryman electric, right?
No. Okay. Because the Countryman is a transverse drivetrain. So the Countryman uses it's actually a through the road hybrid. So the electric motor is on the rear axle on the hybrid on the Countryman, okay. And then the internal combustion engine powers the front wheels. So this is actually the same powertrain that they use in the 3 Series, the 5 Series, and even the 7 Series and the X5. So it's a rear drive setup, and the motor is packaged between the engine and the transmission input.
Okay. How is it? Is it pretty smooth, like when it hands off and stuff?
I felt like it was very, very smooth. And I have to apologize. I misspoke at the beginning. It's not 60 miles of range, Sam. As you said, it's 20 miles of range. But I got, I drove it for a little over 60 miles in EV range. It was very smooth. It was a really smooth transition. I didn't really notice it at all. You know, I guess the question in some ways is it worth it to invest in the E drive? And I don't know if it is. You know, it's obviously you're paying a little bit more there. It is eligible depending upon your state. It is eligible for, you know, federal tax credits and state level tax credits. It's actually not that much more expensive. So the xDrive 30i starts at 43. This one starts at 49. The one that I tested was just over 60,000. That includes destination. So, you know, I think it's to Sam's point earlier of you can do a lot of driving in EV mode. You can, which of course would save on gas and you know, stopping at the gas station and such. But it does mean that you are charging it basically every night because it has a pretty short range. Yeah. So it's that balance between, you know, is it worth it to you or not? I am a topic we'll talk about in a little bit later on the Nissan call with the Aria. I said, you know, I asked the question of how do we convince consumers that an EV is better than what they have currently? And the gentleman whose name, it wasn't Alfonso, it was the other guy who I don't know. And he said, you know, well, you don't have to go to the gas station. I'm like, yeah. And I didn't want to be argumentative. I didn't want to be an ass, but you know, I was like, yeah, but dragging that cord through the snow every night, you know, or you know, the mud and the rain at home is not attractive either. Like yesterday I got gas in New Jersey and I didn't even have to get out of my car.
Well, you can't in New Jersey. You're not allowed.
Right. Exactly. But you know what I mean? Like, I'm like, it's not a big deal to spend 5 minutes at the gas station. It is a big deal. And I've experienced this because I don't pull into a garage at night. I have experienced this, you know, slogging through the snow and the rain, and it's gross. And, you know, so I think that, you know, this PHEV, it's a nice to have. And again, for tax credits, maybe if you're getting, you know, if and when we all start to commute again, maybe there's benefits to HOV lane access and special parking and things like that. But I can't say that I would tell our listeners, you have to get this PHEV. I will say that if this is the size vehicle, this 5-seat, you know, it's a kind of, you know, compact SUV, if that's the size vehicle that you're looking for, I really did enjoy this vehicle. By contrast, I'm actually actively right now driving the Mercedes GLC 43 AMG, and I like it a lot. I will say that it's has a little bit more drama driving it. I do like the X3 a little bit better.
Well, but the AMG is supposed to have a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole point.
I don't mean that it's not fun to drive. I mean, the Mercedes is it's tons of fun to drive.
It's the other stuff that you don't like as much. Yeah.
It's the other stuff, right? Yeah.
So the undesirable drama.
Yes, exactly. Right. No. It's to me, most drama is undesirable. That's my Norwegian side, non-Italian side coming out.
You know, to your point about, you know, who should, you know, whether you should get the plug-in hybrid, you know, I think this is a larger issue just in general with electrified vehicles. You know, the process of deciding what vehicle to buy today, you know, is in many ways more complicated than ever. You know, in the past, you know, when we were just talking about, you know, you might have a choice of different gas engines, you know, it's like, do you want something that's a little slower, maybe a little more fuel efficient, or do you want something that's faster? You know, you go for the big engine or the little engine. You know, now you really have to take into account your lifestyle. Do you live in an apartment? Do you live in a house? Do you live in a house that has street parking, you know, like you do in a lot of city areas, urban areas? Or do you live in a house with a garage? Do you park your car in the garage or in the driveway? All those questions are going to have an impact on, you know, your decision about what is the right choice for you. If you don't park in a garage, you know, a regular hybrid, you know, might be a better choice for you because you don't have to plug it in. You don't have to deal with any of that. You still get great fuel economy. If you can park in a garage, you know, then, you know, what you were talking about with respect to dragging the cord around in the snow or the rain becomes kind of a moot point. One of the reasons why we see a lot of EVs, you know, being bought in California is a lot of these issues they're not an issue for people in California, whereas in Michigan or Wisconsin or Connecticut or Massachusetts, they are more of an issue. If you don't have easy access to, you know, a place where you can plug in, then, you know, then a plug-in is maybe not the right choice. Both automakers and regulators have started to realize over the last few years is a lot of the people that have bought plug-in hybrids end up not actually plugging them in. In which case, now, if you never plug it in, you haven't gained anything over a regular hybrid, but you've paid more for the vehicle. You're hauling around extra mass for that bigger battery, which is actually going to give you worse fuel economy than just a regular hybrid. And, you know, like, for example, in England, you know, where in London they have a congestion zone and you can get exempted from paying the congestion charge if you have a vehicle that, you know, has a CO2 rating below a certain threshold. You know, a lot of people bought plug-in hybrids, you know, to get that, you know, exemption sticker, but now they don't actually plug it in. You know, they found that something like 90%, you know, didn't plug it in. And a couple of years ago, I was talking to Ford, you know, asking about their telemetry data on, you know, their plug-in hybrids that they were selling, you know, how many people actually charged. And they said that roughly a third of people charged their plug-in hybrids every day. A third plugged them in occasionally, and one third never plugged them in. So, you know, this is why BMW has been experimenting with wireless charging, you know, and particularly for plug-in hybrids. You know, for battery electrics, you know, you have no choice but to plug it in at some point. You have to do it. But for a plug-in hybrid, you want to make that process as seamless and frictionless as possible. So, you know, in BMW did a pilot in Germany and then also last year in California with Witricity, who makes a wireless charging system. You know, offering wireless charging. So you have a pad, you know, that you install on the floor in your garage. There's another receiver pad that goes on the bottom of the car, and you just pull in over the pad and it automatically starts charging, and you don't have to mess with a cord or anything. You know, it works, but it's slower than plugging in. But then again, you know, for the size of a battery that's in a plug-in hybrid, you know, it's, you know, you can usually get a full charge overnight anyway. But it's also still considerably more expensive. You know, that price is going to come down. You know, so I think, you know, by, you know, middle of the decade, we'll start seeing wireless charging becoming more readily available, especially for plug-in hybrids. And, you know, then those might become a more popular option.
Right. And it also does still require, really kind of requires a garage.
Yeah.
Because assuming those things can't sit outside. If they can sit outside, that's fine.
You can do it outdoors. The pad's pretty flat. You just put it, you know, you can mount it anywhere. And, you know, these things are designed to be weatherproof.
The price of installing a charger in the home has come down considerably as well. The ChargePoint HomeFlex device is $700 at Home Depot. You know, they're down to $600 in some places. Amazon is working closely with a lot of these companies.
Yeah, I've looked around. You can actually find 240-volt chargers for as little as $400.
Right.
And then depending on, you know, how much electrical work you have to get done, you know, to have a circuit, it could be anywhere from, you know, $300 or $400. Or, you know, if you have a 240 volt circuit in your garage already, then you just plug it in, you're good to go. You know, otherwise it could be anywhere from a few hundred dollars to about $1,000. You know, a lot of utilities will have rebate programs for chargers. So they will give you, you know, 100% rebate on the charger. So you basically get the charger for free.
So I'm actually going to be looking into this. I do have a 220 volt because my solar system runs off of it and it's in the garage. I'm hoping that they don't have to, that they can basically fit it on the same wall, but I will document my experience and let our listeners know.
You know, back to your question about how to convince buyers that the hybrid or the electric is the thing to buy. I think when you do the calculation of comparing the cost of gas versus the additional cost of the electric car and try to make that sort of pencil out your you know sort of payback period, that's bad looking math.
it's
kind of never going to get there over the certain course of normal ownership, but really, it sounds like an automaker PR statement, but really the best way to convince somebody about EVs and PHEVs is just drive one in electric mode. They drive so, electric cars drive so well. They're just, it's such a different experience. It's really pleasant. I think that makes a bigger impact than like, oh yeah, you know, you can run it off batteries for, you know, most of your driving and stuff.
The marketing of EVs has never been accurate in my mind. They really pushed this as an urban solution, which was a terrible idea because very few, you know, urban people have access to a charger.
I mean, who wants a car at all in an urban situation?
Right? I mean, they based it very much off of a California experience. And I am biased in that the New York, Boston cities that I've lived in tend to not have access to electricity, you know, to a plug.
You get nothing.
Right.
Yeah.
this is a great suburban solution.
Yeah.
And always has been. You know, you take the train into the city, but you drive from your McMansion to the train station, and you go to the same train station because you've got to have a permit for that train station. So you're going to the same place every day and then taking the train in. That's a great solution. And having charging ports at the train station even would solve a lot of these. You're there, you know you're going to be at the office for 10 hours a day. Have the ability to charge it at the train station. And, you know, when I was on the barriers to electric vehicle deployment, I talked about this. You know, work with some of these companies, local companies, or companies even that are in the city that people are working for. So if you're, you know, working for Bank of America and you're working in the city, have Bank of America sponsor charges at train stations.
Yeah.
Things like that. Like it's a broader scope.
I think the original challenge, you know, was, you know, urban areas tend to be where you have the worst air quality problems. And so they wanted to replace ICE vehicles with electrics in urban areas because that would address the air quality problem. But, you know, it, as you said, it has its own issues because, you know, where are you going to charge it? Most people if you live in an urban area, you know, odds are you don't have any place, you don't have a dedicated place, or if you do, you probably don't have some place to plug in. And, you know, the other challenge, of course, was the cost of batteries in the first generation of EVs was so high that, you know, you ended up with cars like the Leaf that had a relatively short range. And so, again, that tend to suit the urban environment better where you didn't need the range. But, you know, as we've learned over the last decade, you know, the argument for EVs that really appealed was the performance argument. That's what people ended up actually buying. And that's why Tesla has been successful.
So I have a second vehicle, but I've spent a lot of time talking,
goodness.
So we can pass on that one.
Well, can you at least like give us a tease? What is it?
It's a little Fiat 500X, and it was a riot.
Oh, okay.
It broke my, you know, Fiat obviously is not doing very well. And this thing was just a riot. I mean, it was fun to drive. You zip around in it. You know, it's kind of almost old school. I think the only little bit of a shock to me was, first of all, the fuel economy was absolutely terrible.
Yep.
So I got 22 miles to a gallon in this thing. It's rated for 26. And I wasn't, I mean, yeah, I was kind of tossing it around sometimes, but the other thing too,
but it wants to be tossed.
Well, it does. It wants to be tossed. The other thing too, and we've talked about this on this program before, destination charge of $1,495, which is insane. That X3 has a destination charge of $995, but we've talked about Fiat Chrysler. This Fiat 500X was $35,895. Are you kidding me?
Oh, like, that's a who pays retail kind of thing, though.
I know, but still.
That's stupid. I mean,
obviously, you're not going to pay, but it is stupid. So absolute blast to drive. You know, super cute. You talk about not being anonymous and having a lot of fun drama. This was a fun drama, not anonymous. Everybody looked at it kind of car. But for $35,000, there's so many better choices. And that's why Fiat is where they are today.
All right. Well, we'll pick that back up next week.
There you go.
Sam, what have you you've been driving? You've had a couple vehicles as well.
Yeah. So let's start with the Honda CR-V hybrid.
Oh, really? You want to go that way? You do want to keep it all BMW?
we'll come to that in a minute. Okay. I'll keep the Honda relatively short. When you had it a couple of months ago, Rebecca, you talked about the noise that was coming when it was in hybrid.
Yes, I did.
And as soon as I started the car up, and put it in reverse to reposition it in my driveway, I immediately heard it. I knew what it was. And, it is the sound that that manufacturers are adding to electrified vehicles when they're in EV mode, to alert pedestrians around them. And, the challenge with this, when you're creating these synthetic sounds is, how do you come up with something that is going to provide alerts to, vulnerable road users around you that, hey, there is a vehicle here? Because, someone who is vision impaired, if they're standing at a crosswalk, they can hear, most of the time, hear an internal combustion engine car coming towards them. But it's much harder to hear an EV, coming towards you or a hybrid that's in EV mode. And, so they're adding these sounds to the vehicles that typically phase out, somewhere around 20 miles an hour or so. It sounds like the one you had, that sound was on all the time. They may have made a software change somewhere along the way, because the one I drove, it only came on when you actually put it in gear, when you put it in reverse or in drive. So when it was in park, it was completely silent.
That sound, and I appreciate what it's trying to do, but somebody who is vision impaired would be more likely to call a vet because it sounded like a sick cat.
I think that they're missing out on an opportunity.
This was like, it's like a minor key nails on chalkboard sound. I don't know.
I suspect that the one you drove may have been a pre-production model that may have had a different sound, because the one I had, more like, kind of a spaceship kind of sound to it.
Oh gosh. But the other thing too, people that were walking, it didn't alert people. It alarmed people.
Yeah. That's why I suspect that they may have changed the sound in between the time you drove it and what I drove.
Because of you on this podcast, they listen.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think they're missing an opportunity though, to make the sound something that you can like you download ringtones, you can download your alert sound.
Well, and I think that they will do
dancing.
That. And in fact, Porsche actually on the Taycan actually is offering, you can buy different sound packages for the Taycan.
Huh. That's awesome.
At an extremely exorbitant price.
Of course.
As well. But, it's a Porsche, so it must be. Right. But, I think we will see manufacturers start to do that. I'm guessing we're going to see, more of this, trying to find the right kind of sound to, give you an audio hint of what it is that's coming at you, and provide that alert to people that, hey, there's an electrified vehicle in the area. Beyond that, the rest of it, the CR-Vs, it's a nice compact crossover. We took it to go out to the lake and, took Daisy and out there and, the paddleboard and everything. And, it's great. It's fairly roomy. It drives fine. The driving dynamics of the CR-V are good. It doesn't get the most exceptional fuel economy. It only got about 35 miles per gallon during my week with it. And, I wasn't beating it up or anything, and you know, compared to the RAV4 or the Escape hybrids, you know, they definitely do better. They get closer to 40 miles per gallon. 35 is not bad for, you know, it's much better than a typical gas engine in a vehicle of this type, but it's not exceptional. You know, and then of course, you know, we had the complaints about the infotainment system in there, which we don't need to, you know, beat to death.
Don't need to belabor the point, right?
And you know what, to your point, Sam, I'm just looking back at, because I had the Hyundai Sonata hybrid that got 46 miles per gallon. I mean, and it's a sedan, granted, but still, to your point, like that, I'll look back to and see what I got on the CRV. I don't remember right off the top of my head, but yeah, that was kind of a little bit unremarkable, I thought.
Yeah, I've actually got the Sonata hybrid in the driveway right now. I got it the other day, and so far it's getting like 52. So
wow,
yeah.
And it actually makes kind of a similar sound to the CRV, although it's not as prominent when you're outside. I actually really noticed it when I was going through a parking garage. It was much more noticeable in there because you get the reflection off the wall.
Okay,
the
so garage. I did not notice that I did not have that same experience with the sound.
It's much more subdued in the Hyundai.
And you know what? It looks like I got 35 miles per gallon.
With the Honda?
With the Honda.
Okay.
So I guess that's about what it's going to get, is about 35 miles per gallon.
And I think that's what most people are getting, is somewhere around 35, 36. Okay. So
that's still exactly pretty good. 35. That's still pretty good for that size.
For that size.
I mean, you know, compared to getting 22 in the Fiat 500X.
Absolutely.
In a much larger vehicle.
Right.
Absolutely. No, for sure. I mean, and a much more useful, and for sure. So, yeah. So it looks like that's what I averaged.
But the class, though, the RAV4 and the Escape probably do a little better.
Yeah. They get about 40 to 42.
Yeah.
I mean, when you think about it, like, that is absolutely fantastic. Because you remember that it was always like the goal was 40 miles per gallon for cars. Mm-hmm. Like, that was a stretch goal. Like, so from that standpoint, it's really impressive when we're talking about these numbers.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, even, you know, when they were doing the new CAFE standards, you know, over the past decade, right, when they talked about, you know, 54 and a half miles per gallon, that 54 and a half mile per gallon threshold, that was actually the unadjusted value. That's based on the old original two cycle system, you know, which was always a very optimistic number. And that 54 miles per gallon, you know, in terms of the label values that we actually see in real world fuel economy, that actually translates to roughly about 40, 41 miles per gallon real world. So, you know, having these compact crossovers that are actually getting real world 40 miles per gallon today, you know, proves that it, you know, it is very feasible to get, you know, to hit that threshold, you know, in the type of vehicle that most people are buying today, you know, or a lot of people are buying today. You know, it's very practical, and you're not sacrificing anything in terms of performance. You know, these things have, you know, as good acceleration as, you know, anything we were driving, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, you know, in terms of mainstream vehicles.
Well, if anything, you know, when I had the Prius, and that was a little bit more of a compromise. I felt like it's still from an overall experience, you know, and yesterday I went to pick up something in New Jersey, and the guy that I bought it from, I posted on my Instagram, the guy that I bought it from had a 10-year-old Prius with 306,000 miles, or three, I think it has 310,000 miles on it now. Absolutely loves the thing. So it served its purpose, but there's so many other vehicles out there now that aren't compromising and still getting these, you know, just incredibly, incredibly good fuel economy numbers.
Right. And I think that's a, you know, that's a big part of why, you know, we've seen this shift. You know, you look at Toyota sales, there's been a shift from Prius, you know, to other vehicles, you know, particularly the RAV4 hybrid. You know, the RAV4 hybrid is now Toyota's best-selling hybrid. They sold almost 100,000 last year versus about 67,000 Priuses. You know, and so
is that what Prius is down to? 67,000?
Yeah. The Prius, you know, has been hit in two directions. You know, the people who were early adopters, who were really green enthusiasts, you know, that were Prius owners, a lot of them have gone to EVs. And then, you know, the rest, you know, that just, you know, wanted something with better fuel economy, they've shifted over to other hybrids, you know, that are, you know, more along, that are less weird looking for one thing, but, you know, that offer other capabilities, you know, like what you have in a crossover where, you know, you're, in most cases, you're not giving up that much in terms of fuel economy relative to a Prius. You know, you have 50 miles per gallon versus 40, 42. But, you know, once you get past about 35, you know, 35 to 40 miles per gallon, you know, because when you look at the actual fuel consumption, how many gallons of gas you're using per mile or per 100 miles, that number starts to decrease. You know, it's an inverse relationship. And I can include a link to an article I wrote back in like 2008 or 9 for Autoblog Green that explains it all.
Yeah.
I'll put that in the show notes. But yeah, I mean, you know, once you get past 40, you know, the incremental reduction in fuel consumption and CO2 starts to, you know, taper off pretty dramatically.
Well, it starts to get much more expensive too.
Yeah. So the difference between 40 miles per gallon and 50 miles per gallon in terms of your environmental impact is actually very small. Especially, you know, given, you know, for the average number of miles that, you know, typical consumers drive of 12 to 15,000 miles a year. So anyway, I think that's enough about the CR-V. The other one I had was the BMW 840i.
Which consumed, you know, quite a bit more fuel.
Well, more, yes, but not as bad as you might think. So the 840i is the entry level version of the 8 series. And it's funny, I was thinking as I drove this thing, you know, the first time I ever drove a BMW was 30 years ago. You know, when I was in my first job after college, working at GM, working at the GM Proving Grounds on ABS for what was then Delco Moraine. And, you know, GM had a fleet of competitive vehicles that they used for benchmarking. And, you know, at the time, you know, they had somewhere between 150 and 200 vehicles, you know, in the fleet, you know, around, mostly around Michigan, but in other areas as well, that they rotate, you know, when they weren't doing specific testing with them, they rotated them through various departments at Milford and at the tech center, you know, to give people an opportunity to try them out. And the first BMW I ever drove was an 850i, the original 8 series,
oh,
you know, which happened to have debuted that year.
So what did they think that was competitive with?
Would BMW think the 850i was competitive?
No. What did GM think they made that competed with the 850i?
Nothing really at the time. Probably the closest thing that, you know, that they may have been, you know, may have been a stretch goal for them would be like the Elante, the Cadillac Elante.
Oh, that would have been quite a stretch. Yeah.
Yeah.
Quite a stretch. I think I had the 840 back in March. I'm sorry, April. It was delish.
Yeah, and Dan, you had the convertible previously too.
I did. I think mine was the 850. I had it last summer, and I that car is so much. But when you start to sort of understand who it's for and what it does, it's actually really, really well done. It's so rigid, the mm-hmm. convertible, and I'm sure that the coupe also is just solid and it performs. I mean, you really can't fault these things for performance anymore. They all perform so well that they just scramble your brain anyway.
Yeah. Well, you know, as I was working on a review the other day on this thing, you know, I started going back and pulling up some of the specs on the 850i. So this was 1990, you know, almost exactly 30 years ago that I drove this thing. It was in the fall of that year.
That's amazing.
And that 850i was powered by a 5-liter V12 engine,
which I would take all day, any day. I don't care if it makes 2 horsepower.
That thing had 296 horsepower and just over 300 foot-pounds of torque, which at the time, you know, I mean, that was a lot.
I don't know. That's the same.
In 1990, that was quite a bit. So it was pretty powerful.
Let's see, 200, that's about the same amount of torque as you'd get from, well, I mean, I guess it's 5 liters, so, but from the 302. From the Ford.
Right. And in fact, you know, I had, you know, at the time I had just bought, you know, a 5-liter LX Mustang, which had 225 horsepower.
Right. And so the BMW, know,
which was considered a lot in
1990. Yeah.
You know, and, you know, now, you know, I mean, that's, you know, 4-cylinder engines, you know, do that without, even, you know, getting above idle. But, you know, so this thing had, you know, shy of 300 horsepower, from a V12 engine, which was a beautiful engine. I mean, it was smooth, silk, you know, just, it was amazing. But that car, and you know, it had a unique look to it. It was very unlike, almost unlike any other BMW. The only thing that was, you know, that was remotely like it, you know, was the original M1. You know, it had, you know, this very slim nose, you know, and Dan, you and I were chatting with Casey Liss on Slack the other day about this, you know, about how BMW grills have gotten insane. You know, the original 8 Series had this slimline nose with this tiny little version of the twin kidney grill, and it had pop-up headlights. And it was the only other BMW with pop-up headlights was the M1, the original M1, you know, which also had a similarly small version of the twin kidney grill. You know, and in some ways, you know, that car, that was an interesting period for BMW design, you know, because it was the first attempt to kind of transition away from their classic look, you know, of the forward-leaning grills, you know, the sedans and coupes, you know, from the old 6 Series and the 3s and the 5 Series and the original 7s to something more contemporary and modern. You know, in that same period, you had the Z1 Roadster, which had the doors that, you know, slid down into the sills.
Pocket doors,
yeah. exactly, pocket doors. You know, in fact, my house has pocket doors.
Yeah.
But, you know, so you had those weird doors. You had the, you know, that was the E36 3 Series, you know, which, you know, was a dramatic change for the 3 Series. You know, when all the 3s before that, you know, had the same kind of classic BMW sedan look, you know, and they made a dramatic shift. You know, and then, you know, through that period, the first half of the 90s, they were doing a lot of interesting things. And then, you know, they've gone through several phases over the years since. But, you know, this new 8 Series, you know, is much, much less of a step out for BMW. And it was funny when I posted a picture of it on Instagram, Ben Wadilla, who used to write for Jalopnik, he commented, "Gee, that's a funny looking Mustang." And in fact, when you look at it in profile, the profile is not dramatically different from a current generation Mustang. It is larger. It's almost a foot longer than a Mustang. But, you know, it's got a similar kind of, you know, profile to it. And, you know, so it's much less of a departure design-wise for BMW. But I think it is executed beautifully. I think it, you know, it looks fantastic on the outside. Looks really nice on the inside. You know, again, going back, I look back at the original Car and Driver review of the 850i that Rich Seppos wrote in 1990. And, you know, the interior, you know, BMW interiors in those days were often very stark. You know, you had, you know, it was a very driver oriented. You had the center stack that was tilted towards the driver, but it was, you know, typically very black, stark. You know, this is so much more luxurious. You know, I mean, it feels like a $100,000 car, which is what this one cost. It was $101,450.
Which is quite a deal compared to the original when you adjust the dollars.
Yes. Yeah. I went back again. That 850i in 1990 was $90,000.
Wow.
Adjusted for inflation today, that's $175,000.
Wow.
Right. Yeah. And that first 850, they really did look like no other BMW, and they looked like nothing on the road. They still look modern today, which is, mm-hmm. So that's a design testament. But those were the first, I think, production car with CAN bus or CAN. So controller area network. So I recall just colloquially, there was a couple people who had them in town, and those cars were absolute nightmares to own more than the like typical high end German car was, which was no picnic.
Well, one of the neat details of that V12 engine, it actually had two complete engine management systems.
Right, because there wasn't
it had
a V12.
One for the left bank, one for the right bank.
Right. They had to talk to each other.
It was the first one with throttle by wire. So you had a complete throttle by wire system.
Wow.
And if one engine management system failed or a sensor failed on one side, the thing could actually continue to run on the other half of the engine on six cylinders. You know, just because it had a completely redundant engine management system for the other side of the engine.
Wow.
So it was pretty wild. But yes, they did have a lot of issues with them. But this 840i I drove is a six cylinder engine, so it's half the number of cylinders. Makes 335 horsepower and 368 foot pounds of torque now. you know, which is more power and torque than that V12 did from only 3 liters. It's more fuel efficient. I got about 22 miles per gallon with it. It's faster. It's about 2 seconds faster, 0 to 60. So the rear drive 840i will do about 4.6 according to BMW, and 4.3 if you get the all wheel drive.
Oh, that's and, so quick.
You know, the V12 850 was 6.3 seconds for the same thing. It weighs 200 pounds less, even though it's, you know, bigger and has a lot more features in it than that original one did. So we've made tremendous progress, you know, over the last 30 years. I don't know that this one will be as memorable as that original 8 series was. But, you know, it's in every objective way, it's a far better vehicle than it was then. And I really enjoyed driving.
I was going to say, so all of those things aside, did you like it?
Yeah, oh, I loved it. It was great. I mean, you know, it's one of those typical coupes, you know, that has a back seat that's, you look at it, why bother? You know, just make a nice carpeted shelf to put, you know, packages or car, you know, luggage on, you know, for a weekend road trip. But, you know, other than that, you know, the rest of it was great. I didn't bother turning off the gesture control or trying to use it. You know, it's stupid, but you know, the rest of it, you know, it just worked great.
Yeah, I loved it. I had so much fun with this. I had it back in April, and it was still, you know, we were knee deep in quarantine and no traffic. So I'm driving it across the Tappan Zee Bridge here and just being able to fly.
Well, that's the new Tappan Zee too. So it's like you just look down and you're like, holy crap, I'm doing 120.
Oh my gosh. It's so true. Yeah. And it just was such a cool, again, like that, you know, that sort of classic BMW, really the ultimate driving machine. It continues to be that. And I loved it. And the interior, I had the black and red interior. The interior was just to die for. And the gesture control, I was able to pretty much just ignore it. But I like the dial that they have in mm-hmm. there. I think it's really easy to use. It's funny. I was just looking back at my pictures and I actually don't have my fuel economy, unfortunately, but I don't think it was terrible. You know, I didn't remember thinking it was like, wow, that was bad. But mine tapped out at 100,000, just over 100,000 and some change. But yeah
it's even if you get the M8 competition coupe, you know, that one's priced at 146, which is still less than, you know, the adjusted price of the 850. And it's a far faster car. You know,
much
higher performance car.
And that's like, I remember that with the 850. So the 850 has the twin turbo V8, right? So performance was without question impressive. It sounded good. It was quick. I mean, that it's for that sort of competitive set. Like, what does it compete with? It competes with like the Mercedes SL.
Mercedes, you know, the Mercedes S-Class coupe, you know, and convertible, you know, the SL is a 2-seater, the S-Class coupe, I think, is more the direct competitor for this one. And, you know, maybe, you know, the Lexus LC.
The Lexus, you know, LC, really, I was thinking,
know,
of, yeah.
Kind of these grand touring coupes that are, you know, fairly relatively high performance, but really more for, you know, luxury, you know, to go, you know, go long distances at high speeds, you know, with a partner, you know,
as opposed to
being
that.
A sports car.
Yeah.
Yeah,
GTs are where it's at.
Oh, absolutely, they're fantastic.
So cool.
I'd have a hard time choosing, I think, between the BMW and the Lexus. The LC is really well done.
I love the LC. The LC is great.
Rebecca's like,
the LC, you know, it drives so well, and that V8 engine sounds so good.
Yeah, I do like a Mercedes. I don't know. You know what? I'm just gonna have to try them all.
Exactly. Yeah. what'd you drive?
So I went completely different. It's been Truckville up here, which has been fantastic for all the home improvement. But this week it's a 2020 Ford F-350 Platinum with the 6.7 liter Power Stroke. So
that's probably more expensive than the BMW.
I know, right? How much was that thing?
It's 80. Roughly 80.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so
it's a bargain.
It surprised me. It's not quite as expensive as I thought it would be, and that's even with like the $600 for the white metallic paint, where it looks sharp. It's a good looking truck. It's clearly super capable in a way that I'm not going to be able to really evaluate. But one of the things I did notice about it was even as an F-350, it doesn't ride offensively stiff. So you could, you know, if you had a need to daily it, I guess.
You'd be surprised how many people actually do.
It's I mean, the 6.7 liter power stroke is like hugely powerful. It's very well behaved. You know, it's not like the old diesels, and I think that's been pretty much what we've said about diesels for a long time now. It's just like it starts up pretty quick. There's no waiting for it to glow. It is pretty smooth. It's got enough of the diesel sound so you feel like you bought the big rig. The Platinum has a nice interior, and this isn't even the top trim level of F-Series truck. There's another one above this.
Oh, I think there's limited. Is Limited above Platinum or below Platinum? I can't remember. Keep talking. I'll look it up.
Yeah, it's not the top trim. I think it's like second to the top. And, you know, it's a crew cab. I don't know how many configurations this is available in, but this is the crew cab with, I think, the 6.5 foot bed and the 160 inch wheelbase. So it's big. It's a long truck, but it's not quite as gargantuan as some of them can get. So it will fit, I think, in most places that you wanted to go, in most garages. And it's a nice, luxurious place to be. I will say, you know, Ford is really leaning hard into trucks. And they're doing a great job at it. You know, this is a very well thought out truck. Just all of the setup for towing and the features with the camera so that you can hook the trailer and stuff. And then I think the pro trailer backup assist, I wanted to get the words right, will help you, because that's always the thing, right? When you're trying to back up a trailer and figure out which way do I turn the wheel to make the back of the trailer go. And you end up all crossed up. So they've harnessed the technology to help you with that. And, you know, it's a lot of money, but it's not as much as I thought it would be. And when you're talking about buying something for a business, it really, you know, the money becomes somewhat less of an issue because you can write it down a bit. So there's some of that accounting that you can help you out.
Well, I mean, what they, you know, typically these will be leased.
Yeah, you know, well, and so leasing, I mean, you just basically fix your cost and off you go. And then you lease another one and another one. But the capability is clearly there. If you want to ride around in pretty comfortable environment and also need the thing to actually put its shoulder to the work, this is, you know, that class of truck. COVID has us all kind of stir crazy. I'm like, let's get a travel trailer. Let's go. Let's get one of these things.
Yeah.
And this is a lovely way to travel that way. So again, like, you know, horse people have lots of dough and they pull horse trailers. This would pull the hell out of a horse trailer very comfortably. Yeah.
So as you were talking, you know, I looked it up. The F-350 is available, you know, as a regular cab, super cab, or crew cab.
Right.
With two box lengths, 6 3/4 feet and 8 feet, and the option of single rear wheel or dual rear wheel.
Right. So this is a single.
Five different wheelbase combinations.
It's a lot, you know. Ford does trucks really, like they are the truck company. I know I'm on record as like not being the hugest Ford truck fan, but most of that griping is the sort of materials and the design of the interior. The materials themselves are pretty good, but I just look at it and I'm like, even for $80,000, this is a $40,000 truck in interior. You know, they've dressed it up with some real metal and, you know, a little leather on top of the dash and stuff. It just, again, you should go sit in one and see what you think, because that's open to debate about taste and sort of impressions interior wise. But I feel like it's too expensive to feel so cheap. They've tried, and it's comfy and it's quiet and it's a nice place to be. But I just, you know, that's really the only thing I can gripe about. The truck itself, Ford trucks are just as competitive, I think, as just about everything else. So it comes down to preference. If you can,
you know, it's not unusual for truck owners to accumulate multiple hundreds of thousands of miles on these things.
Yeah. Yeah. And look, if you want to do 300,000 miles. Don't you want to do it in comfort? And so that's a pretty good argument. And the cab is huge. So it's really like it's 2/3 of an expedition.
Yeah.
So
wow.
I mean, if you want an expedition with a big bed and an 8-foot bed on the back, you know, so you can bring your, you know, your 4x8 sheets of plywood home, you know, without having to invade the passenger space. There you go.
Is some of the compromise on the interior in the name of durability?
Maybe. I think what it is, you know, they've got a hard thing to do, right? They've got the F-Series interior goes from the, I don't know, $22,000, $24,000 XL, F-150 XL, all the way up to the Platinum. You know, that's the or whatever's above it. You know, the King Ranch.
The limited is only available on the F-450, and that's the top trim. That's okay. The one that goes up to $100,000.
They all start from the same basic stuff, and that's where I think my offense with the interior comes. It's like you look at this interior and you see all the way down to the XL, and that's all. It's hard to do without making, you know, the $80,000 truck have a unique dashboard or unique you know, materials and stuff. It gets expensive. Although, and stupid, you know, so
to their credit, you know, Ram does it better than anybody.
Ram does a great job. And the way they do it is, and it may not even be more expensive material. See, this is perception versus, you know, the actual like hard cost. It looks and feels better. Trucks is one of the most competitive segments, and I think if you want to really feel like a valued customer and that the company is really listening to you, go buy a truck, because they pay attention to those folks, and they really offer you all kinds of stuff to make your life easy if you have a job to do that involves a truck. And I
know you're right.
I quite like it.
I remember a few years ago, you know, hearing that. For the F-Series, Ford had about roughly 14 million buildable combinations for the F-Series.
Gosh, that's insane.
Yeah, if you add up all the permutations of the different variants, the different trim levels, the different colors, cabs, bed lengths, you know, single wheel, dual wheel, you know, all that different stuff. Yeah, it was around 14 million. And I think it might actually be more now because there's actually more engine options now.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they even have like a PTO.
Yeah.
I mean, I will say this is a great segue because it seems like the Bronco has broken the Ford build and price site quite a bit. Like, I keep getting the little Bronco splash screen. So you know what? Let's just say, like, if you want a truck and you like Fords, the F-350 Platinum is a really nice one, and it's not as expensive as I thought. Even with the diesel, it's a $10,000 option. So this truck is about $70,000 without the diesel, which is, it seems like a decent, you know, in terms of fancy pickups, that's not terrible.
Yeah, it's Super Duty. Yeah, that's not bad.
So the Bronco has finally broken cover, and there's a lot to the Bronco and the Bronco Sport. And so there's two doors, four doors, compact, more soft-roader than off-roader, although I'm sure the Bronco Sport can hold its own. I mean, you guys were in the presentation that seemed like it had just like high point after high point after high point. My Twitter was like on fire with all the Bronco news. It seems like it's kind of worth the wait. It seems like they've done a really comprehensive job.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the thing I wrote in my write up on Forbes about particularly the Bronco, the bigger Bronco, the midsize Bronco, is, you know, what Ford has done, it's interesting, you know, in the past year, they've done this twice now. They're going into a segment where they don't currently have a product, and they've looked around. It's like, who is the leader in this segment? Okay, what are they doing? Let's do exactly the same thing. You know, they did this with the Mach-E. They, you know, they copied, you know, the Tesla playbook for the Mach-E in almost every way, you know, and then add, you know, a few details of their own, you know, that things that, you know, they're supposedly good at. And now they've done it with the Bronco, where they have looked at Jeep and basically completely replicated what Jeep does, particularly with the Wrangler, and then for the Bronco Sport, you know, with the Compass. or at least the Trailhawk version of the compass. And, you know, that now they obviously they have to execute on that plan. But, you know, in terms of picking all the things, you know, what are all the things that people love about Wrangler? Let's do all of that, you know, and you know, they've done that, you know, they, and they've, you know, they've added on top of that, you know, built in some really neat details that, you know, Wrangler doesn't do right now. Things like, you know, on a Wrangler, you can remove all the doors, remove the roof, you know, you get soft top and hard top versions, you know, there's two door and four door, you know, on the Bronco, you have all that. Plus, with a Wrangler, when you take off the doors, there's nowhere to stash them inside the vehicle. You either have to leave them at home or, you know, one of the things they mentioned, you know, that people do, you know, during the presentation was, you know, Wrangler drivers will drive up to the trailhead. They'll take off the doors and they'll chain them to a tree near the trailhead, yeah, you know, and then pick them up on the way out. You know, with the Bronco, you know, you can, there's actually space in the back. To the doors are frameless. The windows are frameless, unlike on the Wrangler where you've got, you know, full metal frame around the windows. So, you know, the doors are much, you know, smaller. They're, you know, half the size, and you can actually stash them in the back, you know, in the cargo area of the Bronco. And they, you know, you, they even have sleeves that you can stick the doors in so you don't scratch them. You know, so you stick them in the sleeve, stash them in the back, and you take them with you. You don't have to leave anything behind. Little details like that, and the handles that are on the front corners of the fenders, you know, there's these little loops that, you know, are both that serve multiple purposes. You know, they talked about the design, you know, and it draws on the original Bronco, but doesn't, it's not a, you know, like a really retro design, you know, and so you've got the raised ridges along the edge of the front fenders, which helps with being able to see where are the corners of the vehicle, which, you know, when you're maneuvering in tight places, that's really important. And then they have these handles on right on the front corners, which are, you know, kind of your spotter guides, you know, but they're also, they can be used, you know, when you've got a canoe or a kayak tied to the roof, you can, that's your tie down point for those. So instead of wrapping the cords or the rope, you know, around, you know, over the edge and tying it to the bumper like you would with a Wrangler, you tie it right to that, you know, so you're not, you don't have the tie downs, you know, or the, you know, the restraints, you know, rubbing against the paint. You know, so just a lot of little details like that, which I thought were really cool.
They did a lot of emotional solutions. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of those, like you get, you're like, oh, this is really great. This makes me feel good because I can just take care of my doors or things like that. Quickly, you know, with just a, it was very, very thoughtful. There's a lot of thoughtful details in it. And I love the fact that it just, it looks like it's supposed to look, you know, like when you unveiled it, you're like, oh, good. That's what it's supposed to look like. There was that sense of that, of meticulous attention to history, without repeating it. You know, it moved the design forward. I mean, it's almost cartoonish, but not in that FJ, you know, in the Toyota FJ Cruiser sort of look. It just was restrained enough. You know, they often talk about like in the studio, in the design studio, where you go over a clay model and you kind of go over it one more time. You smooth out, maybe you just, you know, you take one thing away. And I think that there was a lot of very thoughtful restraint in the design of this to just pull it back from being cartoonish.
Yeah. And it's, they, I like that they've done their own spin on things too. You know, the Ford, solution for the half doors with the actually the, like the hole in the middle. Right. I think that's really clever, and it makes you sort of look twice. And the, yeah, it's hard to argue that the styling is, anything other than eye catching. And the styling has some of the features that are going to continue to sort of remind you that, like, hey, they really thought about this, like the peaks on the fenders. So, you know, where the edges of the car are, that's pretty, smart thinking. So I wonder though, like, is this another product like the Wrangler? Like you talk about, busboys and billionaires.
Yes.
Is this going to expand the market, or is it only going to just consume some of the Wrangler's sales?
That's a really, really good question. I don't know. I mean, I think we could see some incremental growth. We certainly will see potentially some cannibalization, but you know, there may be people who, for whatever reason, you know, Jeep, I don't think it's entirely fair, but sometimes people, you know, are concerned about the reliability of Jeep. And so maybe that was a barrier to purchase for people. I think we'd really have to look at rejector data for people who chose not to buy a Jeep to understand where the market could be for this. And you know, like we've talked about a lot with pickup truck loyalty, there is some element of loyalty here that, you know, Jeep owners may have as well. I do think, I mean, just looking at it right now, I think that there's definitely a lot of potential. My only concern is that this Sport is a completely different vehicle in that way that the Compass Trailhawk is, but there's no indication or minimal indication that that's the case, that the Sport is not the same. It's not built at the same factory. It's a completely different animal.
I think that may be a calculated decision.
Oh, absolutely. No, yeah. I realize that it is, but it's a little bit of a bait and switch sort of thing. I think that it could turn some people off though, that, you know, you go in thinking, oh, I'm going to get that. And then you're like, wait, this is not what I thought it was. So I think I think they're going to have to manage expectations in terms of better defining that the Sport is really a completely different vehicle.
Yeah, I'm a little less worried about that. You know, I think, you know, it's a smaller vehicle. You know, I mean, it's got some of the similar styling cues, but you know, it's enough different that, you know, and you know, the overall layout. You know, the fact that, first of all, you know, there's no removable top, no removable doors. You know, I think, you know, people that want that kind of modularity from a Bronco, you know, and that want, you know, the really hardcore off-road capability, I don't think they're going to be confused. You know, I think they'll, you know, they'll be fine. You know, I think that, you know, while the Bronco Sport has, you know, off-road capability, like, you know, like you and I have seen with the Compass Trailhawk.
Well, it's it's four-wheel drive only, right? That was one.
Yes, it's four-wheel drive only. And so it's not all-wheel drive like the Escape is. Yeah, and I think this is actually one of the interesting things that Ford's done over the past year, this splitting of the Escape, you know, where previously the Escape was tried to be all things to all people, but it was never really an off-roader, even though they kind of alluded to that in some of the marketing. It was never really that off-road vehicle. And they distinctly moved the current generation Escape towards more of, you know, the urban, suburban commuter vehicle and, you know, split that platform now. So you've got the Sport, which, you know, where Escape is all wheel drive, you know, which, you know, is part-time, you know, automatic. This is a four wheel drive vehicle. You know, it's full-time four wheel drive. It's unlike the Jeep, it doesn't have a 2-speed transfer case, but, you know, I think most people probably never use that in a Compass anyway. Yeah. So I think that there's enough differentiation there that people are going to be less confused by it.
Well,
you know.
I mean, I was on a panel and with somebody who had been able to go to the event that they had down in Maryland, and she said she didn't actually, and this is somebody in the field, you know, a journalist in the field. She said, I have to tell you that I have access to all the marketing materials, and I didn't realize that it wasn't built at the same plant, that it really was not related at all. So, you know, and so I don't know. I feel like it's not going to be a barrier per se, but I do think that I would have liked to have seen more differentiation between the two models like Jeep has done with the Compass and the Wrangler.
It's reasonable. I mean, you know, we won't know for sure until they actually start selling them and see how people respond to it.
For sure.
Yeah, and I think too. Well, I mean, she was there and she sort of lumped them all together. I was just going to say, like, seeing them all together, size wise and stuff, that the differences may stand out a little more. So if you see them in that showroom environment,
yeah, but I don't think that it's clear from this was her words from a marketing all the marketing materials. It's not clear that this is a different platform, a different plant, a different animal altogether.
Well, I mean, I think, like, as a marketer, I wouldn't want that to be clear.
Because you're
launching the Bronco brand.
But from a consumer, I would.
Well, so what you're trying to do, though, as a marketer, is you're trying to get the Bronco brand launched and say, look, we have a Bronco for you. If you want to do the Jeep thing, look, there's the Bronco four-door, two-door. Cool. You'd like a little bit more of this or that, or you don't care so much about the removable doors, something a little bit more manageable or less burly. Check out the Bronco Sport. You know, it still has the Bronco flavor. So I can see it. I totally understand that it is confusing and that may be off-putting. Like any other launch, right? It comes down to how good the dealers do.
Yes, it does. We'll see.
But
I think they did a great job overall, though.
Yeah, I agree. And it's really interesting to hear the feedback that it's not necessarily clear like that, because we get so focused on details. It's so easy for us sometimes to lose sight of, like, what it appears like out in the world.
And to the average consumer, you know, I don't think they, in general, really care where it's built or what platform it's on. It's, you know, it's like, what am I going to use this thing for? Which one has the capabilities that I need?
No, that's not what I'm saying, though. That's not the priority. The priority to me is that the consumer understands what they're really buying, that these are two, very, very different products.
Yeah.
Called the same thing, you know, with that same headline, but then there's a significant divergence that needs to be clarified, I think. And as you say, Dan, that is in large part the dealer responsibility. But even, you know, I know that I don't know exactly how many reservations they had, but, you know, again, it's not when you're on the site, you can reserve one or the other. And, you know, reading the Bronco Sport definition, it's not at all clear that this is car based and not, you know, it is all wheel drive, 4x4. But again, I think that people may get something that they're not expecting.
Yeah.
They may reserve something that doesn't have that level of capability, because people may say, oh, I don't need the doors to come off, I'll just get the Bronco Sport, not realizing that it is a completely different animal.
I mean, yeah. I can't wait to drive them to see what the character differences are too.
Yes.
So
for sure. Absolutely.
We'll see how Ford does with these. They've clearly invested a lot in it, and there's a lot riding on this. So hopefully it does expand the market. There is some pent up demand for something that's not a Jeep.
I hope it does really well. I want them to do well.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, Ford, you know, unlike Jeep, you know, where Jeep, you know, predominantly sells those vehicles, as particularly the Wrangler, in North America, you know, Ford does have more of a presence, especially in Middle East and Africa. You know, they sell a lot of Explorers and F-150s and other trucks in Middle East and Africa. And I suspect that there's probably going to be a fair amount of demand from that region for, particularly for the bigger Bronco, much more so. And so, you know, we may see, if you look at total global sales, you know, I think there may be less cannibalization there, mm-hmm. you know, when you factor in the global market, as opposed to North America, where I think you'll see more of the cannibalization of Jeep. By the Bronco. And speaking of Jeep, you know, they didn't sit back this week either. You know, they did a couple of responses of their own. You know, the morning before the reveal, you know, they dropped, you know, the Wrangler 392 concept.
Which that had to have been one of the Easter Safari Jeeps that didn't see the light of day this year.
Yeah, so they're gonna drop a V8 into the Wrangler, a Hemi, 6.4 liter Hemi into the Wrangler, which could be a lot of fun. And then a couple of days later, after Ford for some reason opted not to talk about the hybrid during the launch of the Bronco, Jeep put out a teaser video of the Wrangler 4XE, which is the plug-in hybrid that's launching this year. And you just see this Wrangler going through, this off-road terrain completely silently on battery power alone.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
And they have a diesel version as well, too.
They do have a diesel as well, which you currently cannot get from Ford. I wouldn't be surprised to see, Ford maybe drop the diesel, offer the diesel in the four-door big Bronco.
Yeah.
But they certainly will be doing hybrids and probably plug-in hybrids. Wouldn't surprise me to see them put the plug-in hybrid with that 2.7 liter V6, for a high performance Bronco, similar to what they've done with the Aviator Grand Touring, do a high performance version of that.
So we did have a question about the Bronco too from a listener. Jared Henshaw asked if it's on a new platform or if it's based on the Ranger. And I think it is a new platform that's going to be shared with the Ranger. Is that correct?
It's the next generation body on frame platform that the next gen Ranger is gonna share that platform with this. So it's an evolution of what they have in the and the Ranger today.
Okay, and is that EV or hybrid capable?
Ford has said, they first said a couple of years ago, and they've repeated it since, that all of their new utilities and trucks will have electrified powertrain options available. It's not clear exactly which combination they'll put in which Bronco, but there will be, at the very least, a hybrid version in each of these vehicles. They have that modular hybrid system that they're putting in the F-150 and the Explorer and the Aviator and everything else, and eventually in the Mustang as well. It's based on the 10-speed automatic. They put an electric motor in between the engine and torque converter. That gives them the power boost that they need. Oh, we forgot to mention the drain plugs.
Oh, that's right, yes.
So in the big Broncos, you can get, one of the options is a rubberized floor. And it's got removable drain plugs, so you can go in, pull the drain plugs out, go in and hose it out, hose out the mud, and it just drains down through the floor instead of collecting in there, which is really nice. And also the Sasquatch package.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And the goat modes.
The goat modes, but the Sasquatch, so you can get the the Sasquatch package is the hardcore off-road package. So that includes things like the disc, the disconnectable stabilizer bars, the big 35 inch tires and a bunch of other things in there. And you can order that as a separate package on any of the 7 trim levels. From the base all the way up to, the wild track, or the overland or badland, whichever one.
Badlands,
I think is the top one. So you can get that on any of them. But not on the Bronco Sports. You can't get a Bronco Sport with the Sasquatch package, but you can get it with any of the big Broncos.
Yeah, and this is why I say, there's just a lot of depth here, and mm-hmm. you almost need a bulletin board with a string charts between. Because even with so manual transmission is something that us over here in auto rider world love to talk about. And so you can get it on the Bronco, you can get a 7-speed manual, but you can only get it
with the Sasquatch package.
Right. And you can only get it with the 2.3-liter EcoBoost, which is a fine engine. Don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. That's a good, powerful little power plant. So it's available, but for serious off-roading, really, the automatic is better anyway. Let's not hurt anybody's pride. they know that, so not only for the use case, the equipment level is matched properly. So you've got the 10-speed auto, which is a fantastic transmission with the larger engine, but also, they know what most people are going to buy anyway. Mm-hmm. You need to, if you're interested in the Bronco, you need to go and play with the website. and
they're not
see.
Offering it just with these, fancy aluminum wheels too. I mean, you can get the Bronco with there's two different steel wheel options. There's, you know, the base 16-inch steel wheel, and then there's a 17-inch steel wheel as well. You know, and the base Bronco, the way they describe the base Bronco is, you know, this is, if, you know, they're going to have at launch something like 200 different accessories that you can get, you know, both from factory accessories and from third, you know, aftermarket partners. And, you know, if what you want is not on the menu, you can build whatever you want. You know, you can take the base Bronco and build it any way you want and, you know, customize it to your heart's content.
Like Burger King.
And that thing starts at 30 grand.
I mean, and all the body panels are removable and easily swappable because, like, they really, whether or not you like Ford or you're a big fan of the Bronco or whatever, like, you have to give them respect. They really thought this thing through.
Oh, and I love how similar the two and four door look. You know, you're not compromising a lot on looks if you go to the four door, you know, or if you keep it a two door. But no, they did a lot of things incredibly well here. And those different small details, those emotional solutions, lots of different drive modes. You know, they did a lot of things really, really well here. I hope they succeed. So I was just playing with it a little bit, and it looks like the Wild Track High Speed Off Road is the most expensive.
Yeah, then that's kind of like the Raptor version of the Bronco, right?
Yeah, I mean more directly comparable to the Mojave, the Jeep Mojave,
Gladiator 51,000.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's to start with.
For the four-door, yes. 48 for the two-door. Yeah, but it looks awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, look, if Ford needs to bring this kind of comprehensive, thoughtful approach to station wagons.
Yes.
Like the Flex, because that worked out well.
Well, no, I mean, the Flex, I want a real, like, a country squire. The wood on the sides, make it real wood. Then we can switch patterns. Yeah, I'm sure they'll get right on
it. What else do we have?
All right, let's wrap up with the Nissan Ariya briefly. The Nissan Leaf has quietly been plugging away for a decade. And so Nissan really knows EVs a lot more than some of the other larger manufacturers, and the Ariya is their second product. It's a little bit larger than the Leaf. It's a crossover. And they unveiled it this week. There's a lot to like here. It's not quite the sporty approach like Ford took with the Mach-E. It's a little bit more mainstream. But it's a nice design piece, and it's a good complement to the Leaf. The way they've made it a sort of design showpiece inside with the interiors still bugs me with the screens and the minimal controls and stuff. I'm sure that I'm going to get cranky about that, but that's probably just me.
I'll probably be cranky about it too.
It's beautiful to look at.
But I just give me a good volume and tuning knob, please.
It does have a volume knob from what I can see. It has a volume knob. Tuning, you might be on your own.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's beautiful looking. You know, it is appealing to the market. I like that. As you know, we talked about earlier, EV adoption has been a struggle. And so, you know, maybe getting more people into getting EVs into a size of vehicle that people are buying and, you know, may be a good thing for them.
Yeah. Well, Sam, you did a great write-up on it for Forbes. It kind of went through all the high points.
Well, you know, it's funny. You mentioned the Mach-E, and back in late 2017, you know, Ford did a complete pivot with their EV program. Before the Mach-E, they were working on a front-wheel drive electric crossover that was very much like what this is. I mean, this is basically what the path that Ford was on before they pivoted to the Mach-E. You know, it was, you know, this vehicle, the Ariya, is almost exactly the same length as the Rogue. You know, so that puts it about the same size as a Escape. And that's what Ford was working on, you know, was a more conventional mainstream crossover. You know, this the single motor version of the Ariya is front wheel drive rather than rear wheel drive. You know, Ford went the opposite direction. They followed the Tesla path. You know, this in dual motor configuration, this should actually have, you know, probably pretty similar performance capability to what the Mach-E and the Model Y are doing. You know, it's going to have 388 horsepower from the dual motor. And this will be the first North American model for Nissan that has their ProPilot 2.0 system on it, which is their hands-free, partially automated system, you know, similar to GM Super Cruise and Ford's Active Drive Assist. And we'll be seeing a lot more from other manufacturers in the next year or two as well. One thing to keep in mind is that even though they showed this now, it doesn't go on sale in Japan until about a year from now, and it won't be here in the U.S. until late next year. So it's a good 16 months away from launch before we actually see these things on the road here. And it's also going to start at about $40,000. So it's not inexpensive.
That's before incentives and rebates, which I guess they need to stop sort of relying on those to bring the price down. I mean, 40 grand is...
Is Nissan running out of federal...
As of the end of June, they were at about 145,000 sales.
Oh, so they're halfway through. Is it 300 or is it 200 or 300?
It's 200,000.
It's 200,000.
But
okay.
At the pace that they're selling Leafs,
yeah,
they probably won't hit 200,000 before early 2022.
Right. Okay.
But so at least through the end of 2022, you'll be able to get, if not the full 7,500, at least a partial rebate.
Right, because it starts trailing off when the manufacturer hits 200,000.
Yeah,
they start trailing off that $7,500 rebate.
Yeah,
at least for now. I mean, who knows what's going to happen? Maybe we could extend those rebates, perhaps.
Maybe we'll see.
Is the Aria going to get here before the model? Well, I guess the Model Y is kind of already.
The Model Y is here. Yeah, you can buy them now. There's plenty of them in inventory.
But those are very different buyers, though.
You think so?
Yeah, because the work that we did in Saudi showed a very different profile for somebody who buys a Tesla versus somebody who buys a Nissan.
I guess that makes sense. Yeah, I'm just trying to think, like, if you want an EV in this sort of size and form factor, it doesn't matter. Brand doesn't matter as much as sort of like what's available. But I guess brand matters.
Brand still matters.
Yeah.
I like it quite a bit.
Certainly, I think it probably matters a lot when you're talking about Nissan versus Tesla. You know, I think people that really want a Tesla are going to buy a Tesla. They're not even going to consider a Nissan. But, you know, when you start looking at the broader audience, I think, you know, of people that, you know, want to move to an EV, you know, people that buy Rogues or RAV4s or Escapes today, you know, and they want to move to an EV, and they're going to look at that and, you know, maybe see some of the issues that Tesla's had, you know, the fact that there's no dealers and it's tough to get service. And, you know, maybe they'll say, okay, well, you know, let's give this Nissan a shot.
Yeah. Well, and this is also like, is this going to be shared with the other Alliance members?
Yeah. The platform is a new dedicated EV platform that was developed by the Alliance, and it will be used for other vehicles from Nissan, Renault, and Mitsubishi.
Okay. Well, see, so Mitsubishi, it has some of the sort of oldest, most antique kind of PHEV stuff on the market now, like with the Outlander PHEV, which I think it's probably their best, most saleable product. This could be a shot in the arm for them, where they're just suffering in the market. So,
yeah.
All right, it would be cool to see
That reminds me of one other thing that's changing with this. You know, right today, Nissan and Mitsubishi are the only two brands that sell plug-in vehicles in North America with CHAdeMO charging connectors for DC fast charging.
That's right.
The Aria is, at least for North America and Europe, is switching to CCS. They apparently will continue with CHAdeMO for now, although it sounds like the call that you were on, Rebecca, it sounds like they said that they're going to keep CHAdeMO in Japan. I was on a call with Nissan's new chief operating officer, and the implication there that he, you know, from what he said was that it sounds like they might be going CCS across the board.
So I was on a later call, and I think they may have corrected him because he very distinctly said that CHAdeMO is continuing in Japan, CCS in Europe and the US.
Yeah.
I remembered reading you that CHAdeMO for CCS charging, and then somebody asked him about it.
Yeah, so, you know, CHAdeMO's more established in the Japanese market. You know, they acknowledge that, you know, CCS is, you know, while CHAdeMO had an earlier, you know, a head start in North America with the Leaf, you know, CCS has been taking over. Everyone else is using CCS, and the network of CCS DC fast charging is growing much faster than CHAdeMO. And it also supports higher charging speeds. So this is going to have support for up to 130 kilowatts charging. The Leaf Plus can do 100 kilowatts now, although the car is capable of 100 kilowatts, but the fastest CHAdeMO chargers you'll find in the U.S. are 50 kilowatts.
I think it's going to be really, really pleasant to drive, to own, to operate, because I was really impressed with the Leaf Plus. Mm-hmm. I just thought it was just really, really well done, and it was just so normal. You know, it's like we were talking about before, like just you got to drive an EV to experience, like have that experience. It was just, it didn't matter that it was an EV. It just did everything I needed to do, and there was no compromise. You know, it's just
right.
Other than having to fill it up with electricity.
Yeah. For sure. Do we want to mention still that the new drug that's on the market, Stellantis?
Oh, that's right. Yes.
So Fiat Chrysler and Peugeot or PSA have combined, and of course
they're in the process.
They're in the process of combining, and there's always been a lot of discussion as to what name they would come up with all this PSAs and FCAs and all this different thing. And so the other day I was actually at the eye doctor with my mother when Jeff Gilbert from WWE, right, not WWE, it's WWJ.
WWE. It's a little different. They seem on the top rope.
can't imagine Jeff standing on the top rope.
WWJ sends me a text and says, hey, can I call you in 5 minutes to get your reaction? If you haven't seen the name, don't look. All right, this is interesting. So after they kicked me out of the doctor's office for being on my cell phone, I went outside of the parking lot and he said it. And I was like, my first thought, and I couldn't say this for a wider spread audience because I didn't want to offend, but it sounded like the stuttering sort of version of Atlantis. And I immediately called up the hotels that they have. And I'd actually stayed near one in Dubai that has, you know, that very classic sort of Atlantis hotel look. But that's what my first thought was, it sounds like a weird version of an undersea world. Later on, I saw people talking about how it sounds like a prescription medicine, which I thought was absolutely hilarious.
Yeah, it does. It sounds like the thing you'd see, like, you know, the two tubs on a hillside.
Yes. Like, with some appropriately aged couple,
right,
in there.
Right. You know,
holding hands lightly with this with right. the champagne or the wine glass.
If you have one
them.
Of those boomer deficiencies.
And it lasts for more than 4 hours, please see a doctor.
Right. So yeah, I don't know where did they come up with Stellantis? Have they explained like what the
It's Latin.
Yeah,
it's
there's Latin. Yeah, there's a meaning to it.
It's Latin. What is it supposed to mean? Bad name?
No, Jeff said that the press release was so flowery he couldn't even really read it.
Okay,
it's,
right.
It's rooted in the Latin verb stello, right? Stars.
Right, that's what I thought yes. about. Is like Stella is a star, so Chrysler the Pentastar. So that makes some.
Okay,
and,
maybe.
And the DS brand uses kind of a star kind of logo.
Okay.
So, the best thing I saw, you know, somebody posted. Yeah, you know, it's like. Just call it Jeep Incorporated.
Yeah. Right?
Well, no, then there'll be no parent organization for Jeep to kill.
Jeep is the parasite that kills whatever organization it's embedded in.
Yeah, the curse of Jeep. Yeah, I don't know. I think we should get the – we should do a dramatic reading with music of the press release. I think that's a good
exactly.
idea.
Exactly.
We'll leave that to you to do okay. post-production.
I'll yes, do it then. I'm making a note now. I mean, some names like make sense. Like, although you got to admit, like Daimler Chrysler was sort of blunt and Fiat Chrysler also sort of blunt. Like, yeah, all right. We know what you are. But so I think that now they're trying to bring them both together, maybe. Versus
but
like,
the amount of money that was spent, because you know that they hired some schmancy, fancy, you know,
branding
branding company.
the amount of money that was spent, and that went, everyone in the room went, oh, yes, please. This is like when the Aztec got approved for production. Somebody must have been paid off. Like,
I'm the Aztec, so...
Yeah, I didn't mean to open up a whole
No, no. I just like, I think that that was one of those cars that, like, it was a great idea. It was, clearly it was a really good idea because, like, that's what the whole market is now. Their execution sucked on that. And
well, and rebranding from PSA, FCA, or FCA, PSA is a good idea. The execution on this sucked.
Yeah, that's true. Okay.
To your
that's,
point.
I mean, you don't want to have just a string of random letters as a company name?
Well, and somebody pointed out, you know, it's better than Alphabet. And I'm like, okay, I get that, but Alphabet was like, it's sort of like just whatever. This Stellantis, it does make it sound like something that should come with warning.
Well, so you know what? Our job as a journalist is to use Stellantis as little as possible if we hate it that much. We can talk about it certainly when they report sales or profits and stuff at the corporate level. Stellantis it is, but then when we're talking about brands, the brands are what makes the company anyway. Yeah. So we're still going to talk about Chrysler.
The reality is, most people don't talk about PSA either. They talk about Peugeot or Citroen or DS.
Yeah. So maybe we can just sort of bury the name.
I like it. It's a good idea.
Well, I mean, the parent company of FCA has a name too that nobody knows. What's the Agnelli family's holding company name? So we'll forget about Stellantis anyway. Once the actual merger closes sometime next year, we'll all forget about it except for the quarterly reports.
And we don't know what they're going to be on the stock exchange, right? What they'll be, what the
JEP.
As well.
Truly, that's what they should do.
They should, absolutely. That's funny.
They could have just called it Stella.
Stella!
There you go.
I mean...
You probably couldn't get a trademark on that, though. Yeah. So this is one of the problems. They have to have something that they can actually get a trademark on. So that's why they have to come up with these stupid names or weird spellings for existing words, like infinity with an I.
Yes.
But think about the brand campaign you could run for that. Like, you could introduce the whole company. You could just license that clip from On the Waterfront. I mean...
Stella!
Right, it's perfect.
Exactly.
All right. I'm done giving away free ideas. They're going to have to pay me for more.
You can reach him at dan@wheelbearings.media.
Right, exactly. And we'll split it three ways because it's collaborative here. All right, well, good. I think that is podcast 155. And if there's anything you guys want to talk about, feel free to hit us up. You know where to find us. And in the meantime, we'll keep an eye on things and we'll come back with our own things to chat about next time.
Thanks, everyone. Right.
Bye.
Bye.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.